Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're right here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
And of course, Carol, that's part of a team of 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
And Jason, you can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio every weekday.
Or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News. Jason, earnings season kicking off with a big batch of earnings. And I feel like the one headline, and we talked about it a little bit with Mike, JP Morgan, Citi, and Wells setting aside almost $28 billion for bad loans in the second quarter. And that's a mark only surpassed by the last 3 months of 2008 during the depths of the financial crisis.
Yeah. And I think that's notable. You know, we are careful about making comparisons from crisis to crisis, but those are the sorts of things that do have an apples to apples comparison to some extent, because ultimately that gives us a window into the underlying economic crisis, which is really important. Let's check in with Anton Schutz, President, Chief Investment Officer of Minden Capital Advisors, joining us on the phone. Anton, a very busy day, to say the least. What's the most important thing from your perspective? Is it the bad loan provisions? Is it something else that you heard from the big banks?
Well, so first of all, and I hate to do this, but I have to go back to your comment about the loan provisions and going back to the crisis. And, you know, the banks had to adopt in the first quarter a brand new accounting treatment called CECL, which is a horrible treatment because it's pro-cyclical, right? It makes the banks reserve a lot more when things become uncertain than they would have under any old accounting standard. So when we first got those big charges in April, everybody goes, oh, my gosh. And here we go again. And they all have to subscribe to a bunch of factors, but it's the loss over the life of the loan, which is very different than under the old methodology where you go, look, what kind of losses can I see coming anywhere in the near term? I've got to set aside reserves. Now, if you make a 10-year loan, you got to go, well, how much money could I lose over the next 10 years on this one loan? And it's a much, much bigger number. So believe it or not, the banks are much better reserved than they have been, and their capital ratios are obviously much stronger.
So, right. So it's not about, but I guess the question then, Anton, just to take that a level deeper, is the banks definitely, I think it's undeniable that the banks are healthier than they were in the financial crisis. That, yes. I don't think anybody's debating that or should debate that,
right.
Candidly. I guess the question is, are we overdoing it by saying that there is a certain level of pain and suffering out there, so that what you're arguing is that the number may not be as dire, or the underlying reality may not be as dire.
Sure, it's not apples to apples to prior.
Got it.
Anything
fair? Good.
Prior to the first quarter, so that's really important. And quite frankly, I believe that anywhere in the media, we're the first conversation, even including first quarter earnings, people have had about this. So I've had my fights with FASB about it. And the fact that it's pro-cyclical, right, makes a bank less willing to lend money because they've got to set aside more for any brand new loan that comes in the door. Dumb stuff. It's here. We have to deal with it. So, all right. So here's what's really is important is the loss absorbing capacity, the earnings power of this industry. The fact that JP Morgan can set aside what it set aside and still report positive earnings. The fact that Citibank can set aside what it set aside and still report positive earnings. There's an amazing loss absorbing earnings power at these companies. So that's the good news. And I would say there are pieces of good news out there, right? The guys who have the capital markets, I mean, they rocked it. JP Morgan, you know, amazing quarter. Citibank, incredibly strong quarter. Wells Fargo doesn't have that business of the same size, so doesn't have that as an offset. Mortgage, incredibly strong quarter out there. And so far, credit has behaved. Now, it's behaved for a lot of reasons. Right? All these great government programs, as well as forbearance. And we've seen it across a number of different things. We've seen it across consumer and credit card and auto, and we've seen it in commercial. And really what that forbearance means is, okay, borrower, we're going to give you some more time. We're going to, you know, add the principal interest to the end of the loan period. We'll talk about it when you're ready to start paying. Now, at least on the consumer side, probably about half the consumers have been making payments. So that's the good news. I think that's a very good news. We've seen a number of people requesting forbearance in mortgage, and this is before today. It's just Fannie and Freddie start to drop. People are saying, hey, no, it's okay. I've got it. I can do this. So, you know, if there are some green shoots out here, what obviously is the shoot that's scaring everybody is the reemergence of this terrible disease.
Well, I think that's what we're trying to figure out, right? You know, Anton, the longer this goes on, I mean, I know for JP Morgan, I guess their net charge-offs, if I can get it out, which are their overdue loans, the bank doesn't expect to get back. They were up 6% from the first 3 months of the year. It was less than what was predicted. I guess we're all just trying to, in a world where there's not a lot of visibility, kind of figure out what this recovery looks like on the other side. And I just, you know, it just feels like, you know, there's been a lot of enthusiasm in the equity markets overall and just trying to glean from these banks whether or not things are going to be okay. I mean, ultimately, long term, they will be. But I think we're trying to get an idea of what this next 6 to 12 to 18 months look like.
Right. And that long term phrase is so important. And I think, obviously, the banks and the government, and the banks are a great conduit for moving money to people who need it. Obviously, forbearance has been important. I do think we get more programs coming from the government, depending on how long this lasts. You know, do we need another round of this PPP? And I don't mean, look, there's capacity in the system for first-time users. They haven't used all of it. But what about everybody who has used it?
Right.
You're a restaurant. You've borrowed it. You've paid your people. They've not got unemployment. And now you're shutting back down again. So I think there's some talk in Washington about a second round of this coming, and I think that's great for the borrower, great for employment, and good for the banking system. The banking system has actually generated a tremendous amount of fees. The big banks are donating the fees to charity.
Interesting times, Charlie Pellett. All right, thank you so much. Let's get back to our conversation about the big banks. The earnings season, of course, underway. Anton Schutz is with us, President and Chief Investment Officer at Mendon Capital Advisors. Roughly $190 million in assets under management on the phone from Florida. So, Anton, what's this year been like for you?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, the storm we've seen in the stock prices has been spectacular. And I think, as we talked about earlier, that uncertainty is what's really caused it, not actual losses. Obviously, we've seen the yield curve change dramatically. The Fed's lowered rates a lot, so that's hurt margin. Uncertainty, you know, creates lower loan growth. And then, of course, we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, potential losses out there. And unfortunately, nobody knows all those answers. So it's led to a bunch of my stocks being a lot cheaper than they were. You know, I think some of it is deserved, but much of it is not. And I think that some banks have really done a great job underwriting, and we'll come through this incredibly well. And I don't think we're going to have a lot of failures this round unless things get a lot worse. Mm. And I think we've done a great job about, you know, making stuff not a lot worse. I think the distancing, the face masks. And I know we've got a resurgence, but, you know, I think people want to get back to work. Businesses want to function. We're all adapting to work from home. I think the economy's not going back to where it was a couple months ago. It's the question is it going to go back to where it was, in January or December?
And so, Anton, I know we know you look at regional banks very closely as well. What's the read from some of those CEOs as you look at the numbers coming out from them, on a monthly, daily, weekly basis? What's the read you get on the economy and their health?
Sure. Really good question. Obviously, if you're in a spot that's got sort of a whammy of energy prices as well as what's going on here, you know, a lot more uncertainty in some of the places that have energy. And when you start going into the rest of the industry and you start talking about underwriting and really, you know, picking apart parts of the banking industry that are subject to this, right? You know, if it's retail, that means, you know, strip plazas for the smaller banks. If it's restaurants, generally means takeout, not full service. So, you know, I think there's good news there. The strip plazas, do they have supermarkets in them? Do they have a CVS or a Rite Aid or something that you know, is going to be an anchor and a good anchor and that credit's going to be okay? If it's a hotel, is it going to be a Marriott Courtyard by the Thruway, which people are using? You know, people back in their cars, they're driving. Or is it a hotel by a convention center where no one's going to be using that anytime soon? And those tend to be bigger loans, and they're at the bigger banks or insurance companies. But really pressing the banks for underwriting standards and loan to values. And, you know, if you've underwritten these things at, you know, 50 or 60% loan to value, the bank losing money on this is relatively low. It could become non-performing. It could need help. But the bank actually losing money, becomes a very low probability event. And obviously some banks have been more aggressive and underwritten at higher standards.
As you said, though, before, Anton, you know, some of your investments, you know, have certainly, you know, they're a lot cheaper than they were, you know, before this. And I get that. So what have you had to do to kind of manage your portfolio? Have you gotten out of some names because you just can't deal with the exposure at this point? Have you upped your positions in others? I'm just curious if you get into the specifics of some of maybe what you've been selling, what you've been buying.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good question. You know, certainly during the depths of the sell-off, you know, I don't know, March 23rd was the bottom or where it was, you had a chance to upgrade in some cases. You could sell a small micro cap in, you know, in an energy state and turn around and, you know, buy, you know, Citi or JP Morgan or Morgan Stanley. And I think that in some cases, you know, we've gotten more liquid and we've upgraded to larger names with similar, you know, pricing. We've added names like a Synovus, which is a big regional bank, or First Horizon, which is a self-help story. They're in the middle of a big merger and a lot of cost cuts coming there. So you upgrade, you know, the quality, you upgrade mm-hmm. the liquidity. Those are the kind of moves that we're making. Certainly any of the names that were big positions for me before are still big positions for me today, percentage-wise. None of them have, you know, caused me to go, oh my gosh, they've done something bad. You know, management is key to doing well in any one of the, you know, in a tough environment as well as a good environment. So, you know, underwriting loans the proper way, like I mentioned before, you know, 50% loan to value is going to do a lot better than someone who's lending at 80% loan to value. You know, the risk is very different. And,
right.
You know, when I interview banks, those are kind of conversations I'm having on these day-to-day, you know, Zoom calls. You know, I'll tell you, you got to overrun the Zoom conferences. You know, it's great you can work from home, but boy, are you getting offered meeting after meeting after meeting. And, it's both funny and exhausting.
It is. Yeah, it's a different world, a different way of life, that's for sure. Anton Schutz, thank you for spending some time with us.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it. We know it's a busy day and a busy time, just as you described. President and Chief Investment Officer of Mendon Capital Advisors joining us on the phone. from Florida, Carol.
And he echoes so much of what we've heard from so many people. Like, you know, what happens with the economy? Do we go back to where we were? He doesn't think where we, you know, we go back to where we were a few months ago. But do we go back to maybe what we saw in January and February?
Yeah.
When there is some clarity and much more transparency. And that would certainly change the outlook for so many different companies.
You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Well, this is one of my favorite stories that is in the upcoming issue of Business Week. It's online and on the Bloomberg Terminal already. And I have to say, Carol, I'm not alone. People are reading this story like crazy. I think it's people of a certain age, and I put myself in that category in their 40s. I love the Ford Bronco.
Well, I have to say my brother's rehearsal dinner for his wedding, and we were all glued to the TV set because of OJ and the white Bronco. We were all watching, and I think it became part of our cultural history, whether you like it or not.
Rehearsal dinner.
No, for his wedding. It's just, you know, it's kind of, you know, we all remember kind of that chase in the white Bronco.
We do indeed.
And it sounds like the Bronco, the Ford Bronco, is getting a revival. Keith Naughton has this story. He's Bloomberg News auto reporter. He's joining us on the phone from Detroit. Also, with us is Bloomberg Businessweek editor Jill Weber on the phone from Massachusetts. Jill, don't you know where you were when that white Bronco was on the TV?
Yeah, definitely. And this story, Keith's story, the amazing part is that it actually has relatively little to do with the Bronco, that Bronco moment, which obviously
they
Ford
don't want
to
remember
wrestle with for the last 20 something years, right? And what Keith uncovered in this story is that within Ford, there was this little group of sort of obsessed diehards who were always bummed that the Bronco had gone away. And so for years, they've actually been quietly toiling and basically, you know, fighting upper management for a shot to bring back the Bronco, which lo and behold happened to present itself. On that note, I'll ask Keith, you know, Keith, as you sort of did this story, I'm just really curious, like, what was it about the Bronco that these guys were so obsessed about?
They felt it was a true and pure SUV, and that the way SUVs were evolving, they were sort of morphing into these kind of, they call them crossovers, a cross between sedans and SUVs that are curvy and comfy and not rugged at all. And they saw Jeep over there stealing all the thunder with its Jeep Wrangler, that true off-road vehicle. And they thought, we have this legendary brand that began in the 60s, obviously became infamous in the 90s with OJ, but began in the 60s. And if you go back to that original cool Bronco, they're selling for hundreds of thousands as vintage cars. Why aren't we capitalizing on this?
And so why was it such a hard sell to management, Keith?
Well, for years, you know, they just kept hitting roadblocks. They had one going in the early 2000s, and the CEO at the time, Jack Nasser, loved it. But then that got killed because Ford got embroiled in that Firestone rollover recall scandal. I don't know if you remember that, but you know, there were congressional investigations, and hundreds of people died, and so Ford was losing billions, and they had to start cutting, and they cut the Bronco. It came back again about a decade later, and again the recession bore down on them, gas prices shot up, SUVs fell out of favor, and that program got killed. So they just kept trying, and they would do this group, they called themselves the Bronco Underground, and it's this group of middle managers, and they would do it literally in their spare time, at lunch hours, after work, weekends. They'd be sketching drawings, coming up with business plans. At one point, they convinced a plant that Ford has in South Africa to maybe produce it and ship it back to the United States. So they're begging for factory space. All of these things.
And that's actually, Keith, that's a great way to say, like, I mean, that the what was the actual breakthrough right now that allowed them to bring it back?
Yeah, so finally, then in the middle of this decade, they brought back their Ranger pickup, which gives the mechanical foundation for what a Bronco can be built on. And, you know, those pickups were increasing in popularity. Gas prices plunged. SUVs increased in popularity. Suddenly they had an opening. They took it. They designed it. They're sharing the same factory as the Ranger pickup here in Detroit. And it was revealed yesterday, and it's getting an awful lot of attention.
Well, do consumers? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Joel.
Oh, I just, you know, the cast of characters around this, I think, is also just taking worth taking a moment to talk about. One of which happens to be Chris Farley's cousin. What role does he play in this?
Yeah, so Ford's chief operating officer now is Jim Farley, Chris's cousin, and Jim used to work for Toyota. And in 1994, he was a junior executive for Toyota, living in L.A. And he was driving home from work one day on the 405, and the police near LAX told him he needed to pull over. Everybody needed to pull over because O.J. was coming through in the white Bronco. So Jim Farley, Ford's COO, stood by the side of the road and eyewitnessed the slow-speed chase as it went by. He said he had no idea really what was going on at the time. It took him to, you know, get home and turn on the news to realize exactly what he'd seen.
That is just nuts, right? Like, it's just so great. It's like coming full circle in many
right.
ways.
Well, you want to bring it full circle, Carol? Let me just leave you with this little gem, which was, so Ford announces that they're going to bring the Bronco back, and then they have to postpone it again because that announcement was OJ's birthday. So it got delayed again. They had to push it back a couple extra days.
Keith, this story just seems to keep on giving. But, you know, I think what we're all sort of gravitating toward, though, is this is a really popular car. I mean, this could be a breakaway hit in many ways.
It could. And, you know, the early attention to it suggests that it may. And if so, Ford could really use it because they've been struggling through 3 years of declining profits and losses. So if they could make this thing a hit, and they're doing it with this kind of retro design, it's you get a two-door, four-door, the smaller version called the Sport, you know, it could sell, the Bronco itself, the two- and four-door, could sell 75,000, and the small one could sell another 75,000, the analysts sell it. So that would be a big hit.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you both so
much.
Such a great story. Keith Naughton, auto reporter for Bloomberg. Big story on the Bronco. It is back. Check it out. It's one of the most read on the Bloomberg and on Bloomberg.com. It'll be in the upcoming edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Our thanks as well to Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
So last week, Jason and I talked with Bloomberg Businessweek economics editor Peter Coy. He had this great story talking about superstar cities and how they're not cracked up to, or they're not all cracked up with their, let's try that again. Superstar
not
cities
all they're cracked
aren't
up to
all
be.
They're cracked up to be. Yeah, there's something in my brain. The synapse is not working. And this is especially the case, this is troublesome, for black male college graduates. It's all based on a new study that's out from Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We're talking about MIT. So in today's Business Week Economics, we caught up with the author of that MIT study. It's entitled The Faltering Escalator of Urban Opportunity. MIT economist and economics professor David Autor joins us on the phone from Cambridge, Massachusetts, to talk about his findings. Professor Autor, it's so nice to have you here on Bloomberg Business Week. Tell us about looked into and the biggest findings for you, the takeaways.
Sure. Thanks very much for having me. I'll just mention that I'm also the co-chair of the MIT Work of the Future Task Force that sort of focused on questions about employment and opportunity going forward. And the main finding of this study is that labor markets in dense cities, you know, think New York, Los Angeles, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, have seen a real hollowing out of the set of jobs. On the one hand, a growth in professional and technical managerial work. On the other hand, a lot of growth of services, you know, food service, cleaning, security, entertainment, recreation, home health care, you know, transportation, maintenance, and so on. And a kind of hollowing out of middle skill, office, clerical, administrative, and also a lot of light production work that used to happen in cities. And this has kind of caused people who were at the middle, people without four-year college degrees, to kind of be pushed downward out of that middle stratum into services that are these hands-on services that are typically less well paid and have less room for upward mobility. And that's a big change from, let's say, around 1980, when cities actually offered more skilled work to people without college degrees. You would find much more specialized jobs for the less educated. And I mean, include people who even have a two-year college degree. So, you know, moderately educated folks And this urban opportunity escalator has kind of flattened out. It's kind of stalled. And this has had a larger effect on minority workers, blacks and Hispanics, than on whites, even though it's true for people, all people with less than a four-year degree. It's even more pronounced, this kind of hollowing out of the middle and this relative decline in wages relative to non-urban areas. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I just wanted to ask you, because it's so interesting to synthesize this, David, with, you know, this sort of renaissance that we saw, and I'm talking pre-pandemic here, for big cities, you know, sort of people coming back to the cities and, you know, maybe eschewing the suburbs in some ways. Are those connected or are they just adjacent?
They are connected, and it has been a renaissance for cities, but it's been a renaissance for cities for the highly educated.
Right.
If you're doing finance, if you're doing marketing, advertising, insurance, you know, certain types of engineering, design and creative work, even technology work, those things are booming, and people who do that work earn a lot more in cities, even net of the rising cost of housing in those places. But ironically, as that's occurred, the middle stratum of jobs has just faded away. And so for those who are not doing that elite work, things are getting less good. The opportunities are less favorable. Wages have not kept up with the rising cost of housing. And things have actually relatively improved outside of urban areas. And this may come as a surprise to your listeners. It's actually something of a surprise to me as well. I kind of discovered this in the course of studying the data. But it turns out people have, you know, rank-and-file individuals have figured this out. If you look at the mobility data, you'll see that highly educated adults are moving to affluent, expensive cities, and those without college degrees are moving away. So people are kind of voting with their feet. They had already discovered that the allure of cities had basically faded for people who didn't do highly paid, highly specialized work.
What are the longer-term economic implications of this?
Well, I think the implications are that, you know, we have moved into a very kind of bimodal economy of where automation and globalization have kind of taken out a large swath in the middle. And this, you know, what my work has kind of uncovered, and this, again, this is surprising to me as well, is this is really concentrated in urban areas. Urban areas were distinctive in that they had this thick core of middle-skill jobs in offices and factories and so on. And so as those have disappeared, they've disappeared in cities. That's where they were. Unfortunately, many, you know, cities are blacks and Hispanics in America are overrepresented in cities. And so it means the labor markets in which they are, you know, most invested are the ones where opportunities are less and less favorable. But there's a positive side to the story, which is it's not that everything is getting worse and it's getting worser in cities, so to speak. Outside of dense urban areas, things have moved the other direction. Workers without college degrees have kind of moved up the occupational ladder and up the wage ladder. So part of the reason that urban areas, dense urban areas, look particularly unattractive is because the less dense, the non-urban areas look a little better. So I think, you know, in the long run, it suggests that there's going to be probably more opportunity outside of these traditional places. That's where there's growing demand for care work. That's where more of the elderly are located and have, you know, intensive demand for services. And so it suggests that, you know, the kind of conventional wisdom of, you know, go to the city, get on the escalator, that's your way up the ladder, that remains true for the highly specialized workers, and for others, the opposite is true.
Right. All right. We're going to unfortunately have to leave it there. I have so many more questions. You're going to have to come back at some point. David Otter is professor of economics at MIT, joining us on the phone from Cambridge. Also, importantly, part of an initiative around effectiveness and inequality. This is the core issue of our time, I think, Carol, that has been brought into sharp relief by everything that's gone on, all the debates around social justice and racial inequality. A really, really important topic.
Well, you do wonder about the, you know, how this increases some of the gaps and how it creates, you know, homogenous society perhaps than in cities, right? Which is, we've all looked to cities as being so diverse, and maybe they're not as diverse as we've, you know, led them to, you know, or we've been led to believe.
And they've become less so. I think that's what's so fascinating about this. And you do wonder what role the pandemic has had in accelerating some of these trends or maybe decelerating them. We'll see.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Well, we've been talking a lot about banking. Let's talk about banking and IPOs. A big debut today for nCino. Pierre Naudé is the chief executive officer of that company. He joins us on the phone from Wilmington, North Carolina. And Pierre, congratulations, it feels like, are in order. Your stock is soaring today. Tell us a little bit about what nCino does.
Yes, thank you very much. Obviously, very exciting day for us. I'm so happy for the employees and our early investors. Well, you know, nCino is focused on, it's a cloud-based SaaS platform that enables banks of all sizes and credit unions with a more than a $10 billion opportunity for us to digitally transform onboarding, loans, and account opening. Three very simple things, but massive overhead in these banks to do it in a compliant fashion. And so we focus on those three. We build a single platform on a cloud-based platform, and we see tremendous uptake.
Right. And so you're working with Santander, TD Bank, a lot of those financial firms that are certainly very familiar to our audience. I got to ask you, though, about the IPO just quickly. You came in at 31. As Jason said, the stock is taking up. You're at 52 and change. Do you feel like the bankers priced this wrong? Because initially, the expected price was like 28 to 29. Do you feel like, I mean, it certainly came above that, but do you feel like there was a bunch of money left on the table here?
Yeah, you know, today obviously is an interesting experience. My view is that we're satisfied with what we've done. We are focused on the long term for this company. The IPO was an important milestone for us because of our international expansion and our significant investment in R&D. And this was the right time. And I'm pleased that from tomorrow morning on, I can go back to focus on my customers and my people and the special culture we've built here to actually drive this transformation in banks. Because as you can imagine, you know, 8 years ago, nobody did banking in the cloud. And today, we are the worldwide leader in doing this and helping banks to transform and optimize.
Well, what are some of the growth rates that you're seeing, right? Because this is a big pop and you certainly want to hold on to it, right? You don't want to see it kind of whittle away. So talk to us about the growth rates that you're seeing in your business on the top and bottom line, and also talk to us about what you're going to do with this capital raise.
Yes. So we plan to be a world-class SaaS growth company for the foreseeable future. We do have a plan to be cash flow break even in about 6 to 8 quarters. We made that very public in the process year. Mm-hmm. And so the plan is literally, we've got offices in London, Tokyo, Sydney, Australia, Melbourne, Salt Lake City, Toronto. We are going to accelerate our global expansion. This platform allows us with over 100 currencies and over 100 languages on the Force.com platform. So we really can do what small companies couldn't do before, okay? And so that, in addition to the organic innovation drive that we have, to literally not only focus on commercial lending or the commercial side of the bank. We do that. We do small business. We do it for the retail bank. And it's the first time there's a single platform where you get a 360 view of the customer through Salesforce. And then any product you select or any complex loan or the most simplistic personal loan can be processed right from there without re-entering data or asking for any new documentation. Tremendous efficiency we bring into the banks that actually help them to feel and look much more like a fintech.
Right.
Being nimble and fast and customer focused.
Has that become only more important in the midst of the pandemic, Pierre? I mean, I wonder if the business accelerated because banks figured out that they needed to be a little bit more, as you say, nimble and a little bit more tech savvy, both internally and customer facing.
You know, that's the magic of this approach. We go into the bank first. We actually improve the bank employee experience, give them mobility. They go and work from anywhere, anytime. And then we take that improved processes out to the customers through apps and portals. But phenomenal reaction from banks now, especially you can't commute to New York City, London, etc. And nCino bankers can literally stay home, do anything on their phone. I got a picture the other day from a friend of mine, a bank up in New Jersey, Frank Sorrentino of Connect One Bank.
Yeah, we know
him. Flying in a small plane. Mm-hmm. And they actually, and Frank and Liz was approving loans in the air on an iPhone on nCino. I mean, that's fun stuff, and that's why I love what I was doing.
Are yeah. You know, I know you work with banks that have assets from 30 million to 2 trillion. So are you working, you know, on a day when we're hearing from the big banks, whether it's JP Morgan, Citi, Wells Fargo, are you working with all of these big banks as well?
We are. But what I'm telling my community and regional banks is, guys, for the first time, because of the cloud and the pricing models we have, you can now get access to the same sophisticated technology that only big banks could afford in the past. Mm-hmm. So this truly addresses your growth fears, okay? But we actually address the four main pillars that banks look at. It's cost savings, it's efficiency, it's compliance, and then revenue growth. And we can address all four depending on the cycle of that bank. And so size drives those decisions.
Right. All right. Well, we're going to let you get back to your victory lap here. Pierre Naudé is CEO of nCino, a heck of a debut here on the NASDAQ. The ticker is NCNO, and just taking a quick check,
that's about 168%.
$52, mm-hmm. Almost doubling, 170%, as you say, Carol, right now trading at $83.33.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
Drive away, take a break. We can reach our destination.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close. Back with us is a friend of the show, Walter Todd, Chief Investment Officer at Greenwood Capital Associates. He joins us on the phone from Greenwood, South Carolina. Walter, nice to have you here with us. We do want to talk about the markets, but just tell us about life in South Carolina right now.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. Yeah, it's getting a little stressful down here, I guess. So, last time we talked, I think New York was the hot spot, and so now South Carolina is. But my family, everybody's healthy, so I'm very thankful for that. And, you know, we're making it.
And so from an investor's perspective, and I'm glad to hear everybody's safe and well, Walter, from an investor's perspective, how much pause does this give you as you look across the country? And not to take anything away from your home state or my home state of Georgia, your home state of South Carolina, and the rest of the Sun Belt down there, but it felt like the market yesterday saw those headlines about California, and California being the fifth largest economy in the world, and said, oh, wait, hold on a second. Maybe this isn't so good. Maybe we need to be a little more worried. How do you view it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Jason. When you kind of looked at the headline and you thought that, but then when you kind of looked at the sector performance yesterday, it was actually a lot of the reopening areas like financials and industrials that did the best yesterday. They're actually up. And then, you know, obviously technology took a big hit. Yesterday was very curious. I mean, recognizing the headline reversal in the indices, but underneath the surface, it really had kind of a more positive tone as it relates to the virus. And, you know, you're seeing that again today with energy and materials and industrials really kind of, you know, lifting the market up and some of the areas that have done better under the, you know, worse virus news doing worse.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting if you watch the market, we definitely do see, like we saw yesterday, the market being taken down by a virus head. And I do know that we're kind of transitioning into earnings, certainly because of the bank earnings and the rest of the season to come. I mean, Walter, what are your expectations about what we're going to hear from corporate America about, you know, looking backward, looking forward, about where we go?
Yeah, I think, you know, Jamie Dimon's call this morning was very kind of sobering. He's always very honest and open on his calls, and he talked about the fact that it's very difficult to look out and predict the future. And so I think that's kind of what you're going to hear from management teams. But the issue is, or the, you know, potential positive glass half full scenario is that, you know, analysts have modeled down pretty significant downturn in earnings, down about 40% overall for the market. And when you see companies come in, for example, JPM down 50% versus the model down 60%, that's a win, you know, for the company on a relative expectation basis. So I think there is the possibility that you could see companies, as they report, do some better than expected numbers, but it's not going to be uniform. I mean, take, you know, Wells Fargo is the other side of that coin today, Citigroup as well. It's not going to be, you know, uniform across the board. But in general, I think we could maybe have a better than a very low expectations for those cyclical parts of the market. Now, the technology side that's run, that's another story. Expectations are obviously very high on that front, so that could be a different outcome.
Yeah. And so when you think about how you model a portfolio in all of this, Walter, given what you said about financials, given what you said about technology, are there areas that look, you know, maybe a little bit more ripe than others? I mean, I think about the travel stocks. They've been beaten up. I think about, you know, a lot of the areas, the sort of consumer-facing areas that folks are uncertain about. Where do you look here?
Yeah, I mean, it's 2020 has been quite a year for portfolio management. I think what you have to do, or what we believe you should do, is take kind of a barbell approach to this, and you're going to have some exposure to those areas that, you know, are secular growers like technology and healthcare. But at the same time, despite what it feels like right now with the virus picking up, I think you do want to have some exposure to the cyclical areas as well, whether that be industrials, some financials, energy, et cetera. So I think you want to take, you know, play both sides of that.
Right.
At this point, we're avoiding kind of the really deep, like the travel and leisure areas, because I think that's going to take, you know, longer to recover. But we think having exposure to both areas is important in a portfolio.
I mean, I guess what's interesting about tech and healthcare specifically, Walter, is that, you know, they can stand to benefit to some extent from this and have, in certain cases, pretty dramatically. And, you know, I even think about this name that went public today or priced last night and was on the market today, nCino, this little software company. Mm-hmm. I believe the CEO, at least, is based right up the road from you in Wilmington, and that's where he called us from. At least maybe he's just got a nice beach house. But, you know, this is an area where technology has really, as you say, outperformed in part just because of the way we're living.
Sure. Yeah. And there's definitely fundamental basis or tailwinds for healthcare and tech. It's just a question of what do you pay for that?
Yeah.
And in some cases, you know, you're paying 25, 30, 40 times revenues for some of these companies. And we just think that's a little too much. But there's opportunities, you know, in healthcare, for example. I'll give you, you know, J&J, which we own. That's kind of a value stock within healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, trading around 15 or 16 times it reports in a couple of days. So, you know, there's opportunities throughout the market. We just think you need to be careful. You know, yesterday was kind of a warning shot to say, hey, at some point valuation does matter. Hasn't for a while, but, you know, it kind of peaks its head up every now and then.
Hey, just quickly, Walter, have you been buying, selling in this environment? I'm just curious because, you know, it's interesting you said about the tourist, you know, kind of stocks that you've got to be patient longer. But those are the kind of names that if you are patient, you could get a big payoff longer term. So I'm just curious, got about 30 seconds here, buying or selling that you've been doing.
Yeah. Now, our turnover has been in our large cap portfolio, our kind of main portfolio, has been fairly low. We haven't been doing a lot of shifting, but we've been keeping names in check. So we have exposure to Amazon and Apple and those names, but we've been keeping them kind of in check as they've continued to run, so we don't get outsized, you know, exposure to those when they do kind of come in like they did yesterday, for example.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Walter Todd, always good to catch up with you. Glad to hear all is as well as can be expected down there in South Carolina. Walter Todd, Chief Investment Officer for Greenwood Capital Associates, on the phone from Greenwood in the great state of South Carolina, Palmetto State. Thanks so much for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, you can always listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.